This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 2nd of August 2019. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 2nd of August. This week, our editors were Jane Pickard, Sheila Shepard and Noel and Heather Thorpe Tracy. And your readers today are Heather Thorpe Tracy.
Hello.
Noel Thorpe Tracy.
Hello.
And Jane Harding.
Hello.
And I am your presenter, Roy Faithful. And our main headlines this week are Biffa, Bins in Crisis, Boomtown plan is approved, and prison said sorry after man hanged himself. May we have the story behind the first headline, please, Heather?
Biffa, Bins in Crisis. Winchester City Council will extend its controversial... I'm so sorry. Winchester City Council will extend its controversial waste collection contract, despite receiving dozens of complaints in the last few months. National company Biffa is responsible for disposing of household rubbish from 47,000 households across the district. But this summer, the collection service has been in crisis. Just last month, the City Council sent out an apology after Biffa had caused a backlog of rubbish in several areas. This was due to vehicle breakdowns because of the ageing fleet and problems with staff retention and high sickness rates. Biffa is having to use a high number of agency staff unfamiliar with the rounds. A council report that went to a joint committee with East Hampshire District Council in Petersfield last Thursday said the use of agency staff has, quotes, led to collections being affected on an almost daily basis recently, with collections generally made a day late and crews working most Saturdays, which further impacts staff health and morale. The contract is currently shared with East Hampshire District Council, but the City Council will be continuing with Biffa alone. The report states that if standards do not improve, there could be a breach of contract and legal action. Council leader Lucille Thompson told the Chronicle, "We've come to the end of our partnership with East Hampshire Council, who will now be joining forces with another council." Councillor Thomas Thompson added, "They didn't tell us they would be breaking off the partnership until very late. And by the time they had told us, we were in need of a new contract and had no one to help us work on it, leaving us to pick up the pieces. We were left with very little option, and therefore we will be going ahead and continuing with Biffa." The new contract will keep Biffa as the District Waste Collection Service until October 2020. Councillor Thompson believes the service will be much better after reading the company's latest service improvement plan. She added, "Following a meeting with Biffa's managing director and reading the service improvement plan, I think things are looking up. After the service fell over in June, we told them it's simply not good enough. Since then, it seems they are taking a lot more action. We appreciate there has been a bit of a backlog in July, but that is simply because of the weather. It is a very physical job, and the severe heat has affected the workers' health. It was getting better before then, so I don't think this is a setback." The plan says that Biffa will hire newer backup vehicles in case the older lorries they have break down, a problem that has caused disruption to the service in the past. It also states that an experienced operations manager is now overseeing the service, and that staff are being paid a higher hourly rate. Biffa will call the City Council contract teams every day to check up on service performance. Biffa was asked for comment, but has not responded at the time of going to press.
Over to Noel for the second headline story.
The second headline is Boomtown plan is approved. Civic chiefs have allowed the biggest music festival in Hampshire to expand its capacity by thousands, despite being warned of the risks to public safety. Boomtown now has permission to host a maximum of 76,999 people, including staff and security, after an application was approved at a Winchester City Council licensing subcommittee on Tuesday. This will increase the current maximum capacity by 10,000, but will not be in effect until 2020. The application, submitted in June, received 18 objections and 2 in support. David Payne, representing Cheriton Parish Council, expressed his concern for public safety. If we look at Reading Festival, Reading Borough Council audits ticket sales, but the council in this situation has no independent means when it comes to numbers and can only accept the numbers that are given by the organisers, which are, of course, subject to error. They are even more so subject to error with thousands more people, and should there be a major fire like there was in 2016, the public would be at risk. Many residents from villages near Matterley Bowl have been against Boomtown since it first started. Robert Fox, who has lived in Cheriton for around 50 years, told the committee he had seen the festival grow and grow. He said, "It was about 30,000 at the start, and then it seemed to grow every year, and it won't stop there. These applications will grow to ask for 90,000 people and maybe higher. It's a creeping technique. The event continues to put pressure on the use of the A272, which we use all the time. And for anyone to say that the traffic problem can be sorted, it's just not true." Matterley Bowl is also part of the South Downs National Park, which has worried a number of people. Graham Tarbuck, on behalf of Alsford resident David Templeman, said the festival noise levels are out of place. He added, "These kinds of noise levels are nowhere to be seen in other national parks. We've been told that the noise level will not exceed what Boomtown is already permitted, but there will be changes in the environment around. If you look at other festivals, most have strict noise limits. They are inaudible from strict monitoring points, and although it would be expensive, I think this would be feasible and very necessary for Boomtown." But after nearly 2 hours decision time between committee members Councillor Derek Green, Councillor Fiona Mather and Councillor Roger Bentote, the new permissions were granted. Mr. Stephen Walsh, representing the applicant Boomtown Festivals Limited UK, said, "I understand all the concerns, which are completely legitimate, that have been raised here today, but we must look at the positives of Boomtown. There are a large number of people who visit the area during the festival, which promotes it to people who may not usually use it or even think to come and see it. We have also worked extensively with our traffic management team, CTM. I recognise entirely that the traffic will increase, but CTM have worked with Glastonbury, which has 3 times the capacity, and it worked incredibly well." He added, "It's also important to look at the festival's green credentials. At least 30% of people attending will be arriving by public transport this year." The South Downs Way will be closed from Monday, August 7th to Wednesday, August the 14th.
Now Jane's going to read the third headline story,
which is "Prison Says Sorry After Man Hanged Himself." The prison service has apologised to the family of a Winchester man who took his own life while he was on suicide watch at the city jail. Hayden Burton, 42, a Fathers for Justice campaigner, was found hanged in his cell despite being on hourly suicide watch as part of the ACCT, that is the Assessment, Care and in Custody and Teamwork regime, a scheme designed to care for prisoners at risk of self-harm. He had made threats to kill himself and told a listener he had made a noose which he would use unless issues around access to his money were resolved. Despite this, an officer did not check on him properly, just briefly looking into his cell, and an hour later he was found hanging. His death was not isolated. 2015 also saw the self-inflicted deaths of Sheldon Woodford and Daryl Hargreave. Prevention of Future Deaths reports, criticising the lack of mandatory ACCT training, were issued by the coroner following inquests into all 3 deaths. In a letter to the family, James Bourke, jail governor, said, HMP Winchester has learned a number of invaluable lessons following the investigations into the circumstances surrounding Hayden's untimely death and a number of changes have been implemented to bring about significant improvements in healthcare provision and communications, particularly in the management and implementation of the ACCT plans at the prison. I am sorry that we did not take all the measures that we should have to keep Hayden safe from harm. I do offer you my deepest sympathies for your loss. Hayden's brother, Lee Carter, 47, from Milton Keynes, said, "The governor of the jail came down to the inquest and apologised for Hayden's death, but almost to the hour somebody else had hung himself in the prison. It was clear to us all that there was still a problem in the prison. This whole affair has made me really angry. Not only has the prison service failed Hayden, they are continuing to fail people. It's been almost 30 years since the Wolf Report, and the prisons are still a mess. Lives are being lost as a result." Hayden was arrested in May 2015 for an alleged assault and expressed suicidal thoughts. He had then suffered abuse in jail after he fell into a debt, and he was unable to get access to his money in his prison account.
And that concludes our headline stories. Now we're going to continue with death notices, then Christian comment, followed by letters to the editor, your say, historical items, first person, Belgarum diary, editorial comment, and question and answer, My Winchester. And we'll end with items of general news. And I'll start with the death notices. Barter. Richard John Barter, aged 72, and he died in Sydney, Australia, although he was late of Winchester. Denham. John Trevor Denham, peacefully in Winchester Hospital, aged 89. Goldstraw. Mike Goldstraw, passed away suddenly, aged 68. Maggs. Gerald Austin Maggs, peacefully in Winchester Hospital. Martin, Russell Jesse Martin, aged 87. And that was at... No, it wasn't at that. Miles, Michael John Miles, peacefully after a short illness at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, aged 78. Munns, June Rosebery Munns, peacefully at Flowerdown Nursing Home. Norris, Geoffrey Jeff Norris, peacefully aged 73. Peace, Heather Peace, very peacefully at home. And finally, Whitfield, Ivor Whitfield, suddenly aged 61. Now we're going to continue with Christian comment. Over to you, Jane.
And Christian comment this week is, what defines you in this modern age? I heard recently that one of my former medical colleagues had resigned to do other things. Apparently, he didn't want to be defined by his job. This led me to consider if I had ever felt defined by my job when I was working, or if so, am I still defined in that way, a former consultant psychiatrist, perhaps? When I was doing my ministerial training, I found myself one Saturday morning at a jumble sale at the church, where I was doing my placement. I was about to sell a coat for the princely sum of £10, when we heard an ambulance siren outside. Somebody had apparently fallen and broken her leg. I was suddenly hit with the realisation that I was a doctor and should go and help. Sometimes it depends on the context in which we find ourselves. On holiday, we might say we are from the UK or Hampshire, letting that define us. We might add a village or a particular road for clarification. If admitted to hospital, we are invariably defined by our age and gender, possibly with the luxury of a diagnosis. A 68-year-old female with diabetes and whatever else might have caused us to be there. When I first went to a dog training class and the instructor called out repeatedly, "Lady with the golden retriever, do this," it took me some time to realise that she meant me, as I was the only person there with such a dog. Then there is size or appearance, tall or short, fat or thin, hair, colour, length, etc., makeup, teeth, shaven or beard and so on, disabled or other distinguishing feature, all these could define us. We could ask the question, does our religion or faith define us? Obviously, many Muslims, Sikhs and Jews are defined by their religion in that their religion dictates their clothes and dress. Priests and ministers and also nuns can also be defined by their dress by wearing a collar or habit. But most Christians and some of other faiths are indistinguishable from those around them, and so if they expect others to know what they believe, it must be by their actions or the words they speak. On BBC Radio Solent last Sunday, a discussion was held about what sort of car Jesus would drive if he were alive in today's world. The audience made some funny suggestions, such as a Maserati, but actually other suggestions were that he would go on foot or by public transport. We are all defined by how we live our lives, whatever our job or role and however old we are or what we look like. Those of us who seek to be followers of Jesus need to be conscious of our words and actions. And that was from Rosemary A. Baker.
We'll continue with letters to the editor. If you wish to contact the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by telephoning 01962 860 836. Or you can email news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or you can write to the editor, 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO238AL. Now, there are 14 letters this week, and we'll start with one read by Heather.
Daphne Field writes, "A sad loss. Sir, I should like to add my comments to those of Beverly Morgan in your issue dated July the 18th. I have lived at St. Cross since 1967 when I ran a business for 21 years. Following my retirement, I became very involved with the Church and Hospital of St. Cross as a sidesman, church cleaner, the FATE and local community organisations, and loved it dearly. During this time, it has been my privilege to know and respect the Reverend Reg Sweet, who has helped me and many others to cope with our personal tragedies and worries. I am proud to call him a dear friend. There have been several interregnums and a troubled period with an incumbent when a lot of people left the church altogether, and he was finally rewarded for his unpaid work when he deservedly became Master of St. Cross. I am therefore appalled that in the autumn of his life he has been told that his licence will not be renewed and, worst of all, told that he must leave Winchester, his home for 20 years, and where his reassuring presence has been such a part of all our lives. Obviously, I know nothing about the church politics or rules involved in this harsh decision, but it seems to me very unchristian, and Reg will be sorely missed. He goes with our heartfelt thanks and best wishes wherever he goes. Daphne Field, St. Cross."
Mrs. Hazel Agomba says, "There's no solution. Sir, we should all be concerned about Highways England's proposal to widen M3 Junction 9. It will not solve the congestion problem. It will make things worse. It's a simple fact that more road space attracts more traffic. We are naive to think otherwise. Building more roads to prevent congestion is like loosening your belt to cure obesity," wrote Lewis Mumford in 1955. "The additional solution from more traffic, never mind the construction process itself, will have health impacts on residents across the city, but particularly in the Winnell area and surrounds. Pupils at Winnell Primary School and St Swithin's School, for example, would breathe dirtier air. This is the moment for us to stand up to Highways England and object to this scheme being imposed upon Winchester. Both city and county councils have declared a climate emergency. It can no longer be business as usual. The new administration in Winchester City Council must not fail at the first hurdle. This is an opportunity for them to show their true commitment to their climate declaration and the health of Winchester's citizens. Anything other than outright objection would be tacit agreement to a scheme that is without doubt harmful to both people and planet. Mrs. Hazel Agomba, Egbert Road, Hyde, Winchester."
And this letter from John Seager Green is headed GP Failings. "Sir, I recently tripped when gardening, fell and took the skin off my arm. I cleaned the wound and dressed it, and 2 days later, when I came to change the dressing, I noticed a reddening of the skin, soreness in the arm, and that there appeared to be some infection in the wound. So off I took myself to the surgery, Friar's Gate, to see a nurse, only to be told that the first appointment was available was in 6 days' time. I was obliged to go to the A&E department at the hospital, where I was rapidly seen, suitably treated by charming and attractive nurses, and sent on my way rejoicing. Three things are of concern in this tale of everyday life. A, that the surgery was unable, unwilling to assist, and happily passed me on to A&E. Is the surgery not the point of primary care for patients? Secondly, we are warned against the use of antibiotics, yet if doctors fail to tend their patients, minor infections will grow and require antibiotics. Thirdly, if all practices are behaving in this manner, it is no small wonder that hospital A&E departments are overloaded. Well-paid doctors are failing their patients, failing to provide adequate services, and profiting at the expense of the NHS generally. Things ain't what they used to be. And that was John Seager Green, St Cross Road, St Cross, Winchester, a brother at the hospital who will also be missing Reg from the first letter, the master, considerably.
Call for clarity. We go back to the topic of the first letter. Sir, the new administration on Winchester City Council has told us that the climate change emergency is their overriding priority. I recently asked the portfolio holder for the local economy which she would expect to win if the choice is between carbon neutrality and jobs or growth. Her reply was a classic of the politician's art, saying she believed we could have both whilst not actually answering the question. So the concern must remain for any businesses in the district looking to grow, or for anyone seeking a job in the area. If it's not carbon neutral, will the council be effectively seeking to prevent this in the name of the climate change emergency? It's a real concern and we deserve clarity on the point. Hugh Lumby, City Councillor, Upper Meon Valley Ward, High Street, Meonstoke.
And this is from Miss Elizabeth Thorne. The headline is The Wrong Mantra, and it refers back to the letter I read earlier on about the junction on the M3 being altered. Sir, what a pity Phil Gagg, Chronicle Letters, July 25th, didn't read my letter, Chronicle Letters, July 25th, properly. Instead, he has used it as a jumping-off point for his oft-repeated mantra that more roads equals more cards, which is not correct in many cases. I, in fact, only praised one aspect of the proposed works at J9M3, that rear slip road off to the A34 from the northbound motorway after J9, with a corresponding route for southbound traffic, something that has been needed for a very long time and which will greatly improve pollution in Winchester. I then said that as this would greatly decrease the traffic using the roundabout, there'd be no need to alter the present layout, thus saving time, money and delay. Mr. Gagg's suggestion for anticipating traffic are all very well, but unfortunately not very likely to be taken up sufficiently quickly to make any difference in the short-term time we have remaining. He would even scrap the proposal to build the much-needed A34 slip roads. Elizabeth Thorne, Airlie Lane, Winchester.
And Les Haswell writes, Rotary thanks. Sir, my year as president of Winchester Rotary has recently come to an end, and I wanted to say thank you to you and your staff for all the help and support you have given us during my year. I thoroughly enjoyed my term and was able to present prizes at competition finals, certificates at the Hampshire NHS Trust WOW Awards and Young Duck Doctor Awards, and was one of four judges at the HHFT's Got Talent show in the Theatre Royal. During the year, we also got involved in new initiatives with Henry Beaufort School and Integra 8 Dance Company, which helps young people who have the potential to excel in dance. Our big lunch has become a regular valuable business networking opportunity, enhanced by a succession of top-class local speakers. In conjunction with the cathedral, we organised the inaugural Winchester pancake races. This event attracted press coverage from local and national newspapers, as well as radio and television. And this event will now hopefully become an annual occasion. I announced at the start of my year that I wanted to adopt the Winchester Hospice Project as my one charity for the year, and I have to thank the members for their enthusiastic support in raising funds for the hospice. 11 stalwarts braved atrocious weather conditions to climb Snowdon and raise £10,000, while a masquerade ball in the Guildhall raised around £25,000. Other members, as well as local companies, supported the fundraising, which enabled us to present the hospice fundraising team with a cheque for £40,000. Winchester Rotary has also helped fund projects in Uganda, Tanzania, South Sudan, India and Albania to help with the education and healthcare of some of the most disadvantaged children in the world, and has contributed generously to the Rotary International project End Polio Now. Much of this activity has been publicised and reported on by the Hampshire Chronicle, and I would like to take this opportunity to say a very sincere thank you to you and your staff. You have undoubtedly helped to make my year the success it has been, and for that I thank you. And that was from Les Haswell, past president, Winchester Rotary, Churchill Close, Kingsworthy.
Bob Boddy writes, no easy answers. Sir, Karen McCleary is quite right to quote Winston Churchill as saying that those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Presumably, the lesson she would have us learn is that the referendum of 2016 is inviolable. But why should the referendum of 2016 be democratic and a referendum in 2019 or 2020 be undemocratic, especially since we're now all 3 years older and perhaps a little wiser, having had time to reconsider? Your correspondent also states, quite rightly, that Britain is one of the oldest democracies in the world. But the lesson of the last 3 years is surely that direct democracy through a referendum is incompatible with parliamentary democracy, the traditional form of democracy in Great Britain. It must be clear to all of us that trying to mix two forms of democracy has led to a stalemate in Parliament, thus denying us our democratic rights until a solution is found. Also, since 2016, a new cohort of voters have joined the electorate, and it would be undemocratic to deny them a voice on the issue of Brexit, as it will shape their lives. I seem to remember that David Cameron promised us a once-and-for-all solution to the question of Europe through a referendum. Perhaps the lesson we should learn from history is that there are no quick and easy answers to complicated and difficult questions. Bob Boddy, Egbert Road, Hyde, Winchester.
Chris Gillam writes about Rhodes Claptrap. Here we are, back on the roads again. Sir, Eben Wilson gratuitously boasts his economic credentials, yet shows a woeful ignorance of road transport economics. Chronicle Letters, July 25th. If he knew anything about the subject, he would know that road transport is subsidised to about 3 times the total tax and duty take on the activity, so that imagining the road network is generating the taxes that pay for environmental schemes is an inversion of the truth worthy of Mr. Trump. He would also know that if the quantifiable externalities, costs to society of pollution, accidents, ill health, land use, resource scarcity, climate, etc., directly attributable to road transport were recovered from road users, then the market elasticity of response would be such that traffic levels would return to those of the early 1950s or lower. If he knew anything else about the way transport policy has developed since the Second World War, he would know that neither the Department for Transport nor Highways England have ever done any research on the economic benefits of road building. Even if you regard GDP as a measure of any kind of welfare, no GDP benefit has ever been shown to result from road building. The 2006 Eddington Report, commissioned by the Department of Transport and Treasury, specifically warned that no such causal link could be determined. Eddington incidentally also said that road transport externalities, i.e. the subsidy, should be recovered. Both of these conclusions have been assiduously ignored by the Department of Transport and Highways of England ever since. For all his assertion of economic competence and his gratuitous insolence in describing informed environmental concerns as claptrap, Eben Wilson's letter is entirely devoid of any evidential matter, but replete with all sorts of silly prejudices. He needs to start thinking about what he says. Chris Gillam, Upper High Street, Winchester.
And James Anderson writes, Euro bullies. Sir, our new PM, Boris Johnson, has formed his views about the EU from years spent reporting on it as a journalist in Brussels. Clearly the man is better informed on the subject than most. He has concluded that the EU is deliberately undemocratic to avoid interference from its supposed electorate, Demos Kratos in Greek, or the village has power. Not in the EU, it doesn't. Serious economists advise that the economic effects of separation are, in the scale of things, minor. Yet a siren wail of economic Armageddon appears to be the only discussion in town. That can only be deliberate, to drown out the real debate. Correspondent Edward Phillips does just that in his letter chronicled July the 25th. Universal suffrage was hard won, and we cannot have the EU push it into the weeds as that toothless pretense, the EU Parliament. As Britain's view has crystallised over the last 3 years, so too has the EU's drift to economic hard power. Its treatment of Switzerland is disgraceful. Sign up to our rules or face sanctions. You're small, we're big, and we will force you. Democratic and peaceful Switzerland has done nothing wrong. No liberty and justice there, then. The military nationalism of the last century has been replaced by economic nationalism. Nor is it just far distant in Washington or Beijing, but is right here in Brussels. Could it be that our liberals love Brussels because secretly they share its illiberal sentiments? Certainly too many of our MPs appear to be yearning for an EU-like freedom from troublesome voters. And that was from James Anderson, Wrights Close, South Wanston.
Peter Rees writes, Unhealthy Climate. So it is a sad fact of life that current histrionic activities drawing attention to the state of the globe will certainly make change unlikely. Nothing that is deliberately intended to make our lives worse through these misguided actions will substitute for the unification of all nations agreeing to take the situation much more seriously. It is not brave to break the law. It is more than disappointing to see the Labour Party encouraging such undertakings. I do not take the instruction that Extinction Rebellion are the best anti-social activists around. Neither do I believe that in telling me what I should think, I automatically join a majority. There is absolutely no evidence that all members or even a majority of Winchester constituency Labour Party believe this either. If so, I welcome its verifiable publication. The Labour Party local and national position seems clear. It champions law-breaking, resulting in cancellation of all police leave and planned holidays in strategically Tory-reduced national police forces of 21,000 officers, prevention of emergency services reaching traumatic situations, prevention of NHS staff from getting to work with surgeons unable to perform life-saving operations, prevention of relatives from spending last moments with dying family members, removing public transport from service due to superglued persons. These are the anarchic and ludicrous ER outcomes, and I regret they appear to be the view of some Labour Party members. If anyone is interested in being a real friend of this earth, supporting Extinction Rebellion is the last way to do it. Legitimate, non-law-breaking, mass public protest is the real way forward, planned and cooperatively collaborating with all public authorities. Free speech thus continues to be a cornerstone of our democracy. I'm glad we've not had to wait too long for a party climate change policy, in the same way that it's taken 3 years to determine the official party Brexit policy, arriving seconds before we all go over the edge. Peter Rees, Monarch Way, Winchester.
John Airy writes about Point of Points. Sir, Never a day goes by without another horrific story of a stabbing in our country, especially in London, where we have a mayor who has totally lost control of crime. This is not a solution, obviously, but could we not manufacture knives without a point at the end and instead a straight, flat, blunt end? Never have I seen the actual point of the knife being used for anything. It's only the blade itself that's used for chopping, cutting and slicing, etc. John Airey, Mortimer Close, Kingsworthy.
And Les Sherry writes, cycling delays. Sir, can any of your readers, particularly cyclists, explain why so many cyclists risk their life by riding on the road between Kingsworthy and Winchester rather than use the cycle path? I frequently use this route as a cyclist, bus passenger or car driver, and traffic is often held up by cyclists who prefer to use the road rather than the cycle path. Admittedly, the cycle path is shared by the infrequent pedestrian or jogger, and few cycles have bells these days. Is it that walkers and joggers are likely to have earpieces to listen to music and cannot hear cyclists, even if they have a bell? Is it just that cyclists do not like being held up by walkers but don't mind holding up traffic? The road is so narrow and hilly in places that traffic is often reduced to a walking pace by cyclists. It seems to me to be wrong that a bus full of commuters is reduced to a walking pace because a cyclist prefers not to use a cycle path. And that was from Les Sherry, Church Lane, Kingsworthy.
Too many people. Rosemary Conway writes, Sir, your correspondent, Terence Wall, wrote on June the 20th decrying the amount of attention given to climate change protesters and or the amount of research allegedly given to proving a link between human activities and climate change. He now writes again, suggesting attention should be devoted to practical solutions. It is no wonder if his ambiguous letter was misunderstood, because the energies of protesters and public are not directed at establishing that man-made climate change is a reality. This has long been widely accepted. The reason we're all so grateful to Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg is that so far governments and politicians, albeit convinced of the need to act, have simply failed to do so in time on the scale required. Politicians have virtually ignored warning after annual warning from scientists for some 40 years. Protests such as Extinction Rebellion are needed to keep the issue in the limelight. Now we are told there is actually only 10 or 11 years left to take radical action. That is, we have until 2030. Not 2050, which is the current UK government plans and set as a target. Man-made climate change is already with us. Since the latest UN report and the ER demonstrations, practical specific proposals for action have abounded in the public arena. Anyone who listens to BBC Radio 4 news programmes will hear them discussed almost every other day. The problem is that they require massive technological change and input of capital on a worldwide scale within 12 years. The most important need of all is never mentioned or honestly discussed, and that is for ourselves as a species to control our own numbers by humane, voluntary means. There are 7.8 billion of us on this planet now, three times the number that was ever environmentally sustainable in real politic terms. What is urgently needed for the long term is a concerted global effort to halt and reverse human population growth by national programmes of public education, funding for family planning, and incentives to limit family size to a two-child maximum worldwide. But this is impossible without an honest, sustained public debate on the issues. Rosemary Conway, Westleigh Close, Week, Winchester.
John Manley writes about Long Barn and the future of Alsford. Sir, the Long Barn successful retrospective planning permission raises a number of concerning issues around the robustness of the planning decision process, Chronicle, July 25th. Firstly, a retrospective planning application merely gives carte blanche to any resident, business or developer who wants to land then expand into a local community in the future. But secondly, if the planning committee accepted the 0% vacancy argument, then it clearly shows the lack of proper consideration of this matter. The number of pop-up shops, closures of established businesses, and this is not even considering their profitability, shows their judgment was at best limited, but more than likely flawed. Finally, is the future impact of a decision ever modelled into the planning consideration? Whilst I'm sure some long barn visitors go on into Alresford as it continues to suck the life out of the various homeware shops, will they still do that to visit empty units or charity shops? John Manley, Basingstoke Road, Old Alresford.
And that was the last of the letters to the editor. Thank you very much to all of the contributors. And now it's time for your say. The current heat wave across Europe could lead to a shortage of Christmas turkeys. We asked people if this would cause some Christmas problems. Jane's got the answers.
Well, four people were asked about this. Jane Robinson, 70, retired receptionist from Longstock, said, "This will definitely get in the way of our tradition. I suppose we'll just have to find a large chicken." Nigel Hancocks, 61, technical magister of Winchester, said, "Well, we change it up. One year we have a turkey, the next we have a goose. Thankfully, this year is goose year." Ian Barnes, 74, retired county council worker of Winchester Road, Romsey, said, "Well, we've gone back to having a chicken anyway. We aren't massive fans of turkey." And Victor Reynolds, 80, retired butcher of Main Road, Otterbourne, said, "Oh, I'll have beef instead then. We usually have a turkey, but I'll be honest, I've served enough of those."
Now we're going back through the mists of time for historical news items from our files, and we'll start with 25 years ago, read by Heather.
Friday, July the 29th, 1994. Terrorists planted a bomb at the Hambledon Hunt Kennels in the early hours of yesterday, Thursday morning, during a spate of attacks across Hampshire. The kennels at Droxford were one of three establishments targeted during the attacks, possibly carried out by animal rights activists. Police received their first call yesterday at 12:45 a.m. from the Cottage Patch Kennels in Mislingford near Wickham. Two boats worth £1,500 had caught fire, and police are treating the incident as suspicious. Some 4 hours later, at 4:49 a.m, a package was discovered at Old Hawthorne Farm, Four Marks, about 17 miles away from Mislingford. Police and an army ordnance team rushed to the farm, but the package turned out to be a hoax device. But at the Hambledon Hunt Kennels at Droxford, a bomb was found at 5:01 a.m. near the entrance. Police closed the A32 between Corhampton and Merrington's Garage, Droxford, between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m, and a controlled explosion was carried out at 7 a.m. Huntsman Douglas Hunt said it was the fifth time the kennels had been hit this year. The package was within 10 yards of the house, on a wall by the main road. I discovered it after I'd been alerted by the police and we had to vacate the building. A police spokeswoman said, "We cannot rule out these incidents are connected to animal rights activists." The second item says, staff, governors and parents at Sunhill County Junior School, Alresford, said their farewells last week to a dedicated and popular teacher. Ian Reed, who is taking early retirement, has taught at the school for the past 10 years. Paying tribute to him, head teachers John Sweeney described it as both a happy and a sad occasion. He described Ian Reed as a committed and conscientious member of the teaching profession, and the school had benefited from his great enthusiasm and from his great interest in mathematics. Then there was his love of cricket. Over the last few years, the game had been established on a very firm basis at the school. Two Hampshire County cricketers had worked with the children, and this was all thanks to Ian's enthusiasm and commitment. In the last 3 years, they'd finished Hampshire champions in 1 year, reaching the semi-finals in the other two. In thanking colleagues, governors and parents for numerous gifts, Ian said how much he had enjoyed his time at the school.
Let's go back 50 years ago now, Noel.
Yes, two items from Saturday, August the 3rd, 1969. Here's the first. Although the overall entries for the annual Bishops Waltham Horticultural Show, which took place at the Drill Hall Bishops Waltham on Saturday, did not reach last year's figure, the standard of the exhibits was good, and many people visited the show during the afternoon. Entries were affected, thought the chairman, Captain G. Colville, RN, retired, by more exhibitors who previously entered the novice class, having to enter the open classes. The floral sections were well supported and the standard was good, particularly the miniature arrangements and those for side effect. There were fewer entries in the children's classes due, thought Miss Moody, who was in charge, to the Girl Guides and Scouts being away at camp. Judges did comment on the artistic way most of the entries were arranged and labelled them as budding flower arrangers of the future. And the second item... Comprehensive college systems of secondary education will be adopted for the Winchester and Basingstoke areas. This was decided by majority votes by Hampshire County Council on Monday and formed the climax to months of argument between the supporters of this method and those who favoured an 11 to 18 straight-through system. Now the recommendations will be sent to the Minister of State for Education and Science for his approval, having beaten last-minute efforts to have them rejected. First to be approved was Basingstoke, and the first sign of opposition came when the chairman of the Education Committee, Mr. J. Richardson, announced that he had received a petition from 758 parents of children at Basingstoke schools.
Let's go back to 100 years now with Jane.
And that was Saturday, August the 3rd, 1919. The programme of children's sports, which was to have taken place on Peace Day and which had to be postponed on account of the inclement weather, was held at the Recreation Ground, Winchester, on Saturday. The weather was all that could be desired, and a very large gathering, consisting chiefly of the parents of the children, witnessed the competitions, the youngsters showing a keenness that had in no way been dampened by the fact that the event had been postponed. And the second little item... Yesterday, just before the children of All Saints School, Winchester, broke up for the summer vacation, marked an epoch in the history of the school. Its first headmaster, Mr. J. Whitfield, taking leave of the pupils, having presided over the work of the school for a period of 26 years.
Finally, 200 years ago with Heather.
Takes us to Monday, August the 3rd, 1819. Alsford Lamb Fair on Thursday was more fully attended than usual. There were about 10,000 sheep and lambs penned, and in consequence of the buyers being numerous, they experienced a very brisk sale at full 2 shillings and 3 shillings per head higher than the late Overton Fair. And the second item, Danish captain has invented a new rocket, which ascends to a prodigious height and may be seen at sea at a distance of 100 miles.
And we're back to the present. And it's this week's first person is by George Hayter. And it's read by Noel.
Yes, George Hayter's headline is Try to Ignore the Bullying. You know you're getting old when you spend more time remembering the past than planning for the future. Recently I've been looking back after hearing that John McCrick had died. The loudmouth racing pundit was an occasional work colleague of mine in the early 1980s, before he achieved fame as a TV horse race betting commentator. In ITV and Channel 4's racing coverage, he appeared as a rotund scarecrow performing bookmakers' tic-tac sign language, adorned with deerstalker hat, Sherlock Holmes cape and long grey sideburns. His fame spread beyond racing when he appeared on reality shows from Celebrity Big Brother to Celebrity Wife Swap. Combative behaviour and shocking misogyny made him a surprise TV audience puller. It's not widely known that before his high-profile days in front of camera on commercial television, John McCrick briefly worked for the BBC. His job there was to speed up presentation of betting odds on Grandstand, the epic Saturday afternoon sports show. At the Beeb, McCrick did not speak to camera, but he was visible in the background. He and other programme staff sat in an office area of the studio that was always included in the camera shot of Grandstand's presenters, usually either Frank Boff or David Coleman. just one of several workers in the background, McCririck managed to stand out by wearing dark glasses. Sitting next to him was always a member of the BBC's graphic design department, whose job it was to type betting changes into a computer that superimposed the information on the TV picture. About 1 week in six, it was my turn to do that job, sitting next to McCririck and doing my best to keep up with his changing commands as the odds offered by bookmakers rose and fell. I was new to the BBC and nervous about being assigned to 5 hours live sports programme, so it was no help that McCririck shouted his orders. His rudeness was such that his exhortations for me to, for God's sake, get a move on, brought laughter from the camera crew and everyone else in the studio. The humiliation included being told I was a snail, and I remember that once even the presenter turned round to join in the general merriment at my expense. None of this bullying was seen by viewers. At the end of each outside broadcast segment, when the red light came on and the studio was back on air, McCririck was silent. He took bets from anyone in the studio who fancied a flutter. That bookie role gave him status on Grandstand. He further dominated the studio because the programme's editor and producer were isolated behind glass in the control gallery. Once I was told that McCririck had lost his temper on the BBC's midweek racing programme because he thought the midweek producer was too slow in displaying betting odds. McCririck tried to intimidate the producer by standing in front of the window that divided the studio from the gallery and waving his fist. Then he pounded on the double glazing until it cracked. Being bullied by McCririck was unpleasant, but I managed to ignore his insults and obey his orders without answering back. But a colleague admitted to me that he had asked to be excused work with McCririck because he found the man too scary. That boosted my confidence. My advice to anyone bullied at work or school is to ignore the bully as far as possible and concentrate on your ambition. More than that, use the bullying to fuel your ambition, whether it be by succeeding at work or passing exams. Although McCririck's need to be the centre of attention caused him to abuse people in his pursuit of TV fame, I don't think he was truly nasty. He humiliated himself with his antics, and he did entertain millions of viewers. Sometimes he even made me laugh. So that's...
And now Jane's going to read an alternative look at the news with Belgarum Diary.
Which this week is One Saved, One Raised. A Tale of Two Houses, both broadly similar. One, built in 1906 in Maidenhead, has been listed and is safe from demolition. The other, built in the early 20th century, is now a pile of rubble awaiting redevelopment. It shows the vagaries of the listing system. The Maidenhead house was under threat, but is considered too important to be demolished, according to an issue of the Maidenhead Advertiser. On the other hand, Meadowlands on Stockbridge Road Week was purchased by developers and with its large garden was more profitable as rubble, waiting to be redeveloped for large homes. Judith Martin of the City of Winchester Trust tried to get the building listed at the 11th hour, but the clock tolled and the bulldozer moved in. And this has three photographs on here. One is of the article in the Maidenhead Advertiser of the Brocket in Maidenhead, which was preserved and looks like a very attractive, very large arts and crafts house from the early 20th century. And the other is of Meadowlands, also a very large and attractive house, which has a wonderful field of daffodils in front of it earlier this year, I imagine. And then the third, a great heap of rubble, which is what Meadowlands is today.
Over to Heather for editorial comment.
And this brings us back to Biffa. Poor bin collection service from Biffa. It had been touted as the future Winchester City Council and East Hampshire District Council would unite and share the costs of the waste collection service, which would be better for us all. And in Winchester District, that's around 47,000 households. It had seemed that the joint contract with a private contractor would be more efficient, except that it wasn't. We report on the difficulties caused by elderly vehicles breaking down, chronic understaffing, staff turnover, and generally poor service. A council report states the collection rate is 99%, even though most collections are a day late. This results in the perception of a poor service for customers and reputation damage. Let's be clear, there is no perception of a poor service. It is a poor service. Biffa has clearly mismanaged the contract. Quite how this has been allowed to happen is unclear, as Biffa does not appear to be answering questions from the Chronicle. With luck, the City Council will have learned its lesson in getting tied in with a private contractor that is unable to offer the basics of a decent service.
It's time for question and answer. My Winchester, read by Noel.
Yes, it's a Glenn Gilbertson, 73, retired dental surgeon, now amateur historian of Grange Road, Oxford, tells us what he thinks of Winchester. What is your favourite restaurant or cafe? Oh, the Mano Tower in St George's Street. It has interesting, delicious food, plus efficient and friendly service. What's your favourite pub or bar? Oh, the old jailhouse in Jury Street. Good value, good service, and a serious approach to information, healthy options and dietary restrictions. Plus, no loud music to prevent conversation. What is your favourite shop? Warren and Son, stationery shop in the High Street. It has interesting stock and helpful assistance. What's your favourite building? The Peninsula Barracks complex, sensitively converted to new uses. And what's your favourite view? Oh, the overview of Winchester from St Giles Hill. Who or what is Winchester's biggest icon? It has to be King Alfred, a great king of Wessex and no Danelaw for us. However, my blood group suggests I am of Viking stock. What is Winchester's best kept secret? Queen Eleanor's garden behind the Great Hall. And what is the best thing about Winchester? Has plenty of cultural events. And the worst? Alfred was a great town planner in his time, but now the city centre faces traffic congestion, pollution, a fundamental change in retail activity, and a lack of affordable housing. If there was one thing you could change about Winchester, what would it be? Create the will to thoroughly address planning solutions to the above problems. Maybe free electric public transport in the centre and severe restrictions on internal combustion engine vehicles for a start. That's a good idea. Describe Winchester in a sentence. An historic town with the potential for a great future.
Here's what's on. On the 9th of September at 7 p.m. in the Winchester Cathedral, the author Tracy Chevalier launches her new book called A Single Thread. And this is about the cathedral and its effect on the communities around it. It's set in the 1930s, and the novel is part fact and part fiction, focusing on embroidered cushions and kneelers in the choir and presbytery made by volunteer women. Tickets are from www.winchester-cathedral.org.uk. And we've got two shows at the Theatre Royal coming up. On the 17th and 18th of September, London Classic Theatre presents No Man's Land by Harold Pinter. The play is about two elderly writers telling each other stories that gradually become more elaborate and improbable until the arrival of two younger men forces events to take an unexpected turn. And on the 24th of September, Roger McGough and Little Machine joined up writing. This is an evening of poetry and rock and folk blues from the poet who came to prominence in 1967 with the publication of The Mersey Sound. For tickets for both events, go to www.theatreroyalwinchester.co.uk or you can call the box office on 01962 840 440. Lighting Up Time ends on Friday the 2nd of August at 5:32 a.m. and begins at 8:50 p.m. And on Wednesday the 7th of August, it ends at 5:39 a.m. and begins at 8:42 p.m. If you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings of the Winchester Talking newspaper and the Winchester Talking magazine, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Mary Davis on 01962 711 998. And if there's a problem with your Sovereign or Sapphire player, please try plugging it in and recharging it before returning it as faulty. We'll continue now. Further items of general news, and we'll start with one read by Jane.
And here we have research recruits rise at Hospital Trust. Hampshire patients have been given more access to better care, services and treatments following a significant increase in research activity last year, says the National Institute for Health Research, NIHR. The 2018-19 Research Activity League table shows that Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, which runs the Royal Hampshire County Hospital in Winchester, recruited 3,813 participants into research studies between April 2018 and March 2019, more than 100% increase on the same period in 2017-18. The league table also places Hampshire hospitals in the top 10 trusts in England for recruitment to commercial research studies, having recruited more than 1,000 extra participants into commercial studies in the last year. This performance means the Trust is ranked as the second most improved in England for their recruitment to commercial studies. Dr. Sarah Clark, Research and Development Manager at the Trust, said, "This is a fantastic achievement for everyone at Hampshire Hospitals. Our staff are committed to providing high-quality research opportunities for our patients, and along with the first global participant in 2018-19, demonstrates our capability to successfully deliver commercial research." She added, "We know from feedback how much our patients appreciate being offered research opportunities, and our staff have worked exceptionally hard to ensure as many as possible are given this opportunity. Promoting, conducting and using clinical research to improve treatments, care and services for patients is part of the NHS England Constitution." The NIHR Research Activity League table provides a picture of how much clinical research is happening, where and in what types of trusts, and involving how many patients. Jonathan Sheffield, Chief Executive Officer of the NIHR Clinical Research Network, said, "It's been a fantastic year for health and care research across England, with 100% of trusts supporting research studies, providing patients with more opportunities than ever before to take part in vital research, which improves future treatment and future care. There's a growing body of evidence which suggests that search-active hospitals have lower mortality rates and better patient outcomes, so the NIHR Clinical Research Network will continue to work closely with the NHS organisations to ensure that research continues to be offered to people as part of quality patient care." The NIHR Research Activity League table is accessible to anyone and can now be found online.
Now a historical item. The sealed knot recreates the Battle of Cheriton. Battle brought to life 375 years on. Gunshots echoed through what is usually a quiet village near Alresford as dozens staged a major battle. There's photographs of three drummers with drums slung round their necks and wearing bright blue capes and hats, knee breeches and stockings, really rallying the troops. There are a group of soldiers in top hats and military caps, wearing trousers and a variety of coats, leaning on their very long muskets. And there are also other people hurrying to the site, led by a woman with a parasol and what looked like picnic baskets. Battle brought to life 375 years on. Gunshots echoed through what is usually a quiet village near Alresford as dozens staged a major battle. The Sealed Knot, a natural historical reenactment society, brought the Battle of Cheriton back to life over the weekend, 375 years on from the original conflict. Wearing lifelike costumes, the group demonstrated realistic warfare using a range of weapons from rifles to cannons. Spectators could try archery with the Alton and Four Marks Archery Club and browse charity craft stalls, which were set up by Naomi House, the Royal British Legion and Help for Heroes. The Battle of Cheriton in 1644 was an important parliamentary victory in the English Civil War, helping to secure southern England. the Sealed Knots reenactment was held on the very same battlefield, which remains looking much the same today as it did then. There were also reenactors from other wars, including the American Civil War of the 1860s.
In these troubled times, here's a really important story. Winchester Street gives hedgehog babies a new home. A family of hedgehogs have been saved from uncertain future by residents of Winchester Street. Those living in Weston Road teamed up to ensure the safety of five hoglets which had been roaming in gardens that were potentially dangerous. The campaign started when Carol Wilson spotted one of the babies outside her property in broad daylight. She moved it from the path into the undergrowth where it disappeared from sight. Later that night, her son Edward saw three more foraging in a neighbourhood's garden. Following the sightings, the Wilson family decided to start a neighbourhood hedgehog watch, in which five hoglets were discovered in total. They have since been moved to the Hughes' house, which is considered much safer for them. Carol Wilson said, like every street, Weston Road has two sides. The problem is, one is perfect for these prickly creatures, but the other is less than ideal. The local community got together to discuss the best solution and plan the move. The ideal would be a nearby garden that was contained while allowing free movement between surrounding gardens, with natural habitation offering shelter and plenty to eat. These baby hedgehogs were too young to be separated and fend for themselves. They were not yet ready to live alone, still needing each other's warmth, food and water. She added, they now live all together in a safe hedgehog haven across the road. Millie and Georgie Hughes, aged 9, had the perfect garden and were happy to take all five. The hoglets were introduced to their homemade feeding station and settled into their new home. Residents have since had regular sightings, reports and stories of the hoglets' well-being, and Carol said they have brought such joy to the entire neighbourhood. They are now urging other Winchester residents to look after local hedgehog families. Their advice includes consulting the British Hedgehog Preservation Society and local hedgehog rescuers, and to leave water in shallow containers around the gardens, especially in warm weather. And this is accompanied by three photographs, all taken by Carol Wilson. There's one of a hoglet crossing the road. And then there's a picture of Edward Wilson, her son, with a hoglet in his hand. He's very sensibly wearing gardening gloves. And then a delightful picture, irresistible, of the two girls, Millie and Georgie Hughes, 9 years old, in red T-shirts, smiling delightfully, each with a hoglet in her hands, and again, very sensibly, wearing gardening gloves.
And here we have Homes England grant helps reduce rents at new scheme. A multi-million pound grant will help ensure affordable rents at a new Winchester City Council development. The scheme in the Valley, where 77 homes, flats, houses and a bungalow are being built, will benefit from 6.4 million from Homes England. The 18.9 million scheme will be helped by the funding, which will mean it can provide social rents, making it more affordable for tenants. Councillor Kelsey Lerney, Cabinet Member for Housing, said, "Our ambition is to provide truly affordable homes in the right places, ensuring the district can be called home by as many people as possible. This funding will help us to achieve this goal, and we will continue to seek new and innovative ways of providing more affordable rental properties across the district." Peter Jones, head of affordable housing at Homes England, said, "We are pleased to see these new and much needed homes for social rent being provided in Winchester, helped by our investment." And this is accompanied by a view of two of the homes on the Valley. And I'm not sure if these have already been built or this is a projected view, but they show houses with very modern sloping roofs and upstairs balconies and verandas and a wonderful view behind to the hills. And looks as if they're quite a lot bigger than the houses, the older houses just behind them, but a very happy-looking couple walking through a possible meadow, really, to get to the houses.
can assure you they haven't been built at the moment.
They haven't been built
it's
yet.
A
right.
large mound of chalk. They've right. had to landscape the area, so
thank you.
A long way to go.
Right.
A small mound with a history. We're going to historical item now. In the Farley Mount Country Park is a small mound which has an important history. There is a map of the Hursley area drawn by a map maker called Ralph Trenswell for the new owners, the Holby family, in 1588. On this map, the mound is marked with two names. The second is difficult to read and is rough. Do any of the local inhabitants know what this name is? However, the first name is clear and is Robin Hood's Butt. And there's a photograph of Robin Hood's Butt in Farley Mount, which I recognise because when the children were young, we used to take them there and that was home to play pom-pom in a variety of hide-and-seek. I expect other families did the same. There is probably no real connection with Robin Hood. Many places were named after Robin Hood from the 16th century on. The term butt was used because mounds like this were used to place archery targets on when practising. All men were supposed to have bows and to practise regularly from the 13th century. It's possible that this site was used for archery practice, but it is remote from most settlements, so seems more likely that it was just a nickname for a mound that looked a little like an archery butt. There is no doubt that the mound is, in fact, a prehistoric burial mound. It was known place in the landscape at least from Saxon times, when it marked the meeting place of several estates or parishes, Murden in Hursley, Farley Chamberlain and Sparshot, with Ashley very close as well. It seems likely that the mound is mentioned in the boundary points of the Saxon Charter of 909 AD for the large Chilcombe estate, as the place called Theara Ealdan Chelmstowe, which means the old execution place. A site like this on the boundary of several parishes and very close to the line of a Roman road from Winchester to Old Sarum was often chosen as an execution place in Saxon times, although it seems this one had gone out of use by 909 AD. The east-west boundary follows the line of the Roman road, except at this point, where it deviates 200 metres to the south to meet the Hursley boundary at Robin Hood's Butt. The significance of Robin Hood's Butt declined as the high point of Farley Mount, about a kilometre to the west, became important as a beacon site, which was used at the time of the Armada. And there's a photograph of the building there too. In the 18th century, Paulet St John, 3rd Earl of Bolingbroke, erected a monument there to his horse. The inscription said, "Underneath lies buried a horse, the property of Paulet St John, Esquire."
And we've got more modern history. Students unearth a 1940 hurricane from farmland. Students have shed fresh light on the crash of a hurricane fighter plane in World War II. The crash site of the single-seater, which came down near Wickham in November 1940, has been successfully excavated by students from Winchester University. The undergraduates recovered wreckage left behind following the wartime RAF recovery, including parts of the cockpit instrumentation, control column firing button, found set to fire, and crucially, one of the aircraft's identification plates that confirmed it as a pilot officer Hugh Desmond Clark's Hurricane N2608. Poignantly, the harness release, which would have been the last item handled by the pilot before he parachuted to safety, was recovered. 10 archaeology undergraduates spent 2 weeks researching and excavating the site, led by Dr. Phil Martyr, senior lecturer in archaeology and an expert in World War II aviation archaeology. A geophysical survey was followed by 3 days' excavation last Thursday through to Saturday at Frith Farm. The site has not been explored for nearly 80 years. Dr. Martyr said, "This project has provided a unique opportunity for students to explore the story of just one pilot and his aircraft that participated in the aerial combat taking place in the skies of Britain during late 1940. We hope that their experience will help them to appreciate the value of this type of heritage and encourage them to play an active role in its future. We are extremely grateful to the landowners, Mr. and Mrs. Arturi, for allowing us to work on their land and making us feel so welcome. We're also grateful to our project partner Gareth Jones and his team for their support, and to the Joint Casualty and Compassionate Centre at Innsworth for their advice during the licensing process. The Hurricane was being flown by Pilot Officer Clark while intercepting enemy aircraft on November 1, 1940, the day after the Battle of Britain officially finished. Pilot Officer Clark retired from the RAF as a wing commander in 1960, and as part of their project, the students are researching his military career and hoping to trace any living relatives in the hope that they can tell his story and add this to their excavation report.
And now, Jest of All Fun to help Jack's Place Hospice. Young adults, carers, nurses and local bands came together to put on a festival at a Sutton Scotney hospice. On July the 6th, the garden at Jack's Place was filled with teepees, stalls and colourful decorations for the first ever Jestival, hosted exclusively for the young adults staying there. Live music was provided by a number of acts, including the Winchester band The Moorside, who entertained the crowd with well-known indie pop hits, as well as posing for photos with the spectators. Play team leader Hugh Bromage said, "We'd like to say a huge thank you to everyone involved for making our first ever Jack's Place Festival a success. The food was a particular highlight, cooked in our own brand new barbecue hut in the Jack's Place garden by our wonderfully talented kitchen team, as was my glitter beard. We had brilliant feedback from the young adults at Jack's Place, who really enjoyed the day and particularly enjoyed the live music and all of the staff getting into the spirit with festival dress code and glitter face paints." And this is accompanied by two photos, one of the young people sitting around in their chairs listening to somebody singing and playing on the guitar in the sunshine, and another large photo of two of the young people in the wheelchair in a colourful teepee, and quite clearly there's the glitter face paint is making them smile as well. I think it's being put on at the time by the people there.
Winchester girls join thousands in the United States for Scouts event. There's a picture of two smiling girl scouts wearing hats and with scarves around their necks against a green background. They are Olivia Crimlier and Isabel Witt. Two Winchester's girls have joined tens of thousands of young people in America for one of the biggest scout events in the world. Olivia Crimlis, aged 17, and Isabel Witt, aged 14, are two of the 5,000 scouts from the United Kingdom taking part in the Jamboree, a skills and adventure festival taking place in West Virginia, which ended on August the 2nd. The pair are with 45,000 scouts from nearly every country in the world, sharing skills whilst taking part in various adventures throughout. Olivia said, "The great thing about Jamboree is that we get to do things we can't do at home. We did scuba diving, and it was great to get the chance to do it with lots of other scouts from across the world." This year's event was opened by United Kingdom Chief Scout Bear Grylls, who said, "World Scout Jamborees only happen every 4 years, and tens of thousands of scouts attend each one. They are incredible festivals of peace, friendship and adventure. Young people will make friends for life with people from over 150 countries.
Casting light on the city's hidden past. This is more archaeology. Winchester Beneath Our Feet, a one-day festival archaeology, proved to be such a success that a repeat in 2020 is likely. Given the beautiful day, the 20 or so who took chance to experience hands-on geophysics on Oram's Arbour were lucky. However, the indoor activities at the Winchester Discovery Centre also proved popular. The learning rooms house a crowded tabletop exhibition where representatives of Cotswold Archaeology and Pre-Construct Archaeology Winchester, Winchester Excavation Committee, Hampshire Cultural Trust, Winchester City Council, Council for British Archaeology, the University of Winchester, Hyde 900, Hampshire Field Club and Archaeological Society, and WARG, the Society for Winchester Archaeology and Local History, were all busy explaining their past activities and future plans. Many of them had archaeological finds on display, with some available for handling. One particularly interesting exhibit was a triptych of the Hyde 900 community dig created by Chris Pryor, garden designer of King Alfred Terrace Hyde. And there's a picture of that. It's rather beautiful. Triptych showing the archaeology in process. The well-attended keynote speech by Professor Martin Biddle, Winchester walking in the footsteps of Alfred the Great, filled the lecture room. Professor Biddle led many important digs in the city centre between the 1960s and 1980s, hailed as among the most important in the last 100 years. He explained that while traditionally Winchester's regular street plan had been thought to reflect the Roman city, in the last 50 or so years, it has become clear that it is instead a planned Saxon town. The High Street runs beside the Roman main street, not on top of it. It was clearly intended to be a major commercial street, with the frontages on the High Street served by parallel service streets. Today's St George's Street to the north and St Clement Street to the south are their remains. Between these and the city was a grid of streets which terminated in another road running below the walls. This pattern was destroyed in the southwest corner, which became a political religious centre with a royal palace, the minsters, the Nunna Minster, the cathedral and the bishop's palace. Dick Selwood's talk on the history of archaeology in Winchester, particularly since the 1950s, and Professor Nick Thorpe's presentation on a Roman site in Meon Valley, which had photographs only a few years old from this year's dig, were both a few hours old, I mean, from this year's dig, were both well attended. Mr. Selwood, part of the organising team, said everyone involved was very happy with this year's event and we hope to put on a bigger and better version in 2020.
And now New City Hotel officially opens. Travel Lodge has officially opened its new 7.5 million hotel in Winchester city centre. The 62-room Winchester Travel Lodge, with its entrance on Market Lane, is the company's 583rd hotel and the 18th in Hampshire. It has created 15 jobs. It is also the Travel Lodge's second hotel in Hampshire to offer super rooms, the company's premium economy room concept. It was officially opened by Bryn Taylor, Travel Lodge Regional Director, and Aman Sanger, District Manager. Mr. Taylor said, "We are delighted to open the first of two hotels we are opening in Hampshire this year. We have officially opened Winchester Travel Lodge today, and we are on schedule to open Gosport Travel Lodge at the end of the year. They will also create 35 new jobs. This is also great news for the local economy, as our research shows that customers will spend double their room rate with local businesses during their stay, which equates to a multi-million boost for the local economy." The hotel is being managed by Daniel Potts, who celebrates his five-year work anniversary with Travel Lodge this year. Mr. Potts said, "To be given the keys to Winchester's first Travel Lodge is the perfect way to celebrate my fifth work anniversary. I feel very privileged to be managing Winchester Travel Lodge, and I'm very proud to have built a fantastic team who are as passionate as me about delivering great customer service. Our hotel has got off to a flying start, and with our central location so close to the cathedral, we are ideal cost-effective base to explore Winchester and the surrounding areas. We are set for a busy year ahead, and we are already seeing bookings for the Christmas market season. Our super rooms are a massive hit with both businesses and leisure customers." And this is accompanied by a picture of the official opening with the ribbon being cut and a team of very, very young-looking helpers and lots of red, white and blue glittery balloons and all holding up a glass of something sparkling, I think.
Teenager in the charts. And there's a picture of an absolutely beaming 17-year-old called Emilia Tarrant, who has featured in ITV's Love Island. A Twyford teenager's music career has been given a boost after her debut single was played on a popular TV show. Emilia Tarrant, aged 17, released her first song, If You Want Love, on July the 12th, and it's already been used on the small screen in ITV's Love Island. The Peter Simmons students' track featured for 3 minutes as backing music during an episode on July the 28th, which has given her hundreds more listeners and followers online. She said, "It's surreal and very exciting. I've watched Love Island for a few years and have always imagined my song being played. So when my debut single was played, it was unbelievable." Emilia grew up in New Zealand between 1 and 5 years old, before moving back to the Winchester area and attending the Westgate School. She's now studying A-level music, A-level media and BTEC digital music production. If You Want Love is a cover, and it's now reached, her version has now reached number 17 in the UK Shazam charts and has been Shazammed nearly 13,000 times. Shazam is an application that can identify music based on a short sample by using the microphone on a smart device such as a mobile phone. Emilia added, "I never thought it would reach this position, and I'm truly shocked. It's been an amazing experience being able to release a cover of NF's beautiful song."
Call for action after Prime Minister's police pledge. The chairman of Hampshire Police Federation has called on Prime Minister Boris Johnson to follow up his words with actions after his vow to recruit 20,000 more police officers in the next 3 years. According to Alex Charge, the government should return the 1,000 police officers in Hampshire who were dropped due to budget cuts, and said that 20,000 new recruits in the UK would put us back where we were in 2009. This comes after England and Wales police forces lost more than 22,000 police officers from 2009 to 2017. He said the announcement by newly elected Mr. Johnson will be overseen by a new National Policing Board. Mr. Charge said it is a really positive and good challenge, but it's not as simple as that, as after government cuts, our training capacity has shrunk. So it is also about having enough space for these officers. It's really key that we're honest with the public, which is fundamental, and where is the money coming from? The police operation in Winchester has downsized from the now demolished station in North Walls to Mottisfont Court on the High Street. He added, "I hope we do get the 20,000 officers, and this will be key to maintaining a trusting relationship with the government. We've been telling them we need more resources, and now they appear to have listened. But we need to hold them to account for the delivery of this promise." He said, "When public taxes go up, people deserve to get more for their money and see an improvement in the police. It's a good start, but we need more officers to provide the quality service that all officers join the police to provide." Cabinet Minister for Healthier, Safe Cities and Southampton City Councillor Dave Shield said, "It would probably take 5 years to recruit that number of police officers, and there would be nowhere to put them. So can we trust the guy? Where is the money coming from? Where are the police going to be placed? And why were they cut from the force in the first place? People living in Portsmouth and Southampton are experiencing 40% of all crime. So it would only be right for us to get 40% of the police officers. In February, we were promised 210 officers if we increased the council tax preset specifically for police by 14.25%, but only 80% of police officers have been recruited.
And here we have stepping back 200 years to Peninsular War campaign. Soldiers from the past have been on parade in Winchester to commemorate Salamanca Day, the Rifles regimental birthday named after the Peninsular War Battle of 1812. The 2nd Battalion, 95th Rifled reenactors were on duty at the Royal Green Jackets Museum. Visitors stepped back in time, with staff also wearing Regency costume and learning about life as a rifleman during the Peninsular War. There was a visit from the actor Jason Salke, who played Rifleman Harris in the TV series Sharp, together with memorabilia from the film set. In comparison, visitors could also find out what it was like for a rifleman serving in the same regiment 100 years later during the First World War. And this is accompanied by a picture, a very colourful picture of all the people in costume. There's a 5 or 6 ladies looking slightly Jane Austen-y in their Regency costume, but behind them a team of a dozen or so men in full rifleman costume with their rifles and their tall hats and black uniforms with all the buttons down the front, probably borrowed from the TV series, I imagine.
And that's all we've got time for today, I'm afraid. I'd like to apologise for the poor sound quality on my microphone for the first 45 minutes. I managed to diagnose and correct that halfway through. Thank you to our editors, Jane Pickard, Sheila Shepherd and Noel and Heather Thorpe Tracy. Thanks to our copying and dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And thanks to our readers, Heather Thorpe Tracy.
Goodbye.
Noel Thorpe Tracy.
Goodbye.
And Jane Harding.
Goodbye.
And from me, Roy Faithful, thank you for listening. Goodbye for now. And I hope you have an enjoyable week ahead. When you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and please place the correct address label on the front of the wallet too and return the wallet as soon as possible. Thank you and goodbye again.